You've got a very good question here. Referring to the fall of Adam, when Adam was made, he was brought into contact with the gross material world. The gross material world stimulated him so that he began to absorb matter. How was the formative triangle brought into contact? Was the contact a test for the formative Adam, in that the gross material stimulus was a new one? If we remember that every being is a zone from which an impulse at the center radiates up to a limit, and that the limit is determined by the presence of other centers also radiating. So if we like to cover the whole of this paper with circles, each one with a central dot to represent its impulse, then we can see this question about the formulation of a new stimulus is not true. If we take any one of these circles, we'll take this one, and we will find six other circles around it. It doesn't matter actually which one we take, because the behavior of all of them is identical under identical stimuli. Let's take this one and call it Adam. We've arbitrarily selected this one out of an infinite field of such possibilities. Now, the external world for him is simply the world which he infers, because changes occur at his edges which he did not initiate. When a change occurs inside here and it is initiated from the center, then he would call it a change initiated from his internal world. But if a change occurs for which he has no internal cause, he's forced to postulate an external cause, an external stimulus to account for it. Supposing we say that he vibrates and produces a series of circles. If he were in isolation, there'd be nothing except circles rippling from the center and back again. In fact, he finds some other ripples coming in, which by their very form prove themselves not to be initiated in the center. So that all around him here, at the points where the situation is such that a ripple arises for which he cannot account, the totality of these stimuli on the perimeter, not originating in the center, are called by him the external world, the gross world. So there's nothing new about the stimulus. The stimulus is eternal, because, as we've said very often, we can go on, if we wish, pushing these circles all round until we cover up the whole of the paper. We could select another one and repeat the analysis. If all these were quiet, this one initiating a ripple from its own center and the ripple returning onto the center, then this being, which is a solo being, would be aware only of itself. It would initiate a ripple, the ripple would go to its limit and be reflected back, and all that would happen would be the simple pattern of a ripple from the center to the perimeter, and the perimeter reacting back onto the center. And that being would then have no concept whatever of an external universe. But because these other beings exist and are active, it therefore follows that wherever there is contact, there is a ripple, the very form of which shows that it did not originate in this center. And this formal stimulus, not originating in the center, is interpreted by this being as belonging outside itself. and it then postulates that there is an external world. Now, the only thing new about it is not the stimulus situation itself. It is the becoming aware of that stimulus by this being. And this depends on the amount of energy in it. Let's postulate that this being is tremendously energetic and sends out very, very big ripples, so great that they completely dominate its consciousness. We'll see later on that this is part of the ideal towards which we strive. This being, in sending out ripples so powerful that they completely overlay any weaker stimuli from outside, so that in fact this being is aware only of itself and what it initiates. Such a being we would call an autonomous being, a self-determinant being. And it will be totally unaware of an external being at all. But if for some reason it ceased for a moment to send out those energy ripples from its own centre so that they became weakened, then relatively the impulses from other centres around it would begin to obscure its own ripples. And gradually it would be completely obscured by the environmental action of other beings. And this is what we refer to when we refer to the fall. If we can take a nice clean being with no ripples in, this one will do. Here's a being in its original soul state, standing without any ripple, just waiting to see what will happen. This is the state that the quietists in a mystical religion try to reach, where they erase all the motions in the soul so that whatever there is originating beyond itself will come into it. So it will have a stimulus from there. And if it inhibits its own initiating activity inside, then its substance reflects faithfully the character of the stimulus from outside. That gives him objective knowledge of another being. We'll put a very pure soul out here for a moment. This one has kept itself very, very quiet. And all the others around here, I won't bother to draw, and we'll postulate that they were being so quiet that this one could be very, very quiet except at this point. And this one isn't quite so quiet and sends out a ripple. That ripple then introduces a formal change in the substance of this one. Now, we've said before that we are only conscious of the substantial modifications of our own being. Just like if we postulate consciousness to belong to the ocean, all it knows is the ripple, the waveform on itself. If all the waveforms disappear, it knows nothing. The subject can never become an object to itself. The observer is not the observed. So, this soul then, having completely inhibited its own action, would receive a stimulus from outside and identify with the character of it, and the result would be an objective knowledge of the state of the being responsible for that ripple. This is how we can understand other people best. If we deliberately cut down on our own contribution, instead of guessing what they mean and getting a nice, happy sentence ready before they finish theirs to hit them with, if we can inhibit all those things and allow them to come at us so that they ripple a perfectly pure soul substance, then the form that appears in our substance is identical with the causative form in them. So that the quietest method of understanding the universe is to rub out everything that is contributed from one's own centre and see what is contributed by other centres round about. So in this question about the fall, the gross material world is simply that world which we postulate to exist because ripples come through our substance which we personally did not initiate. Thus, if I look at the light up there, and then with my eyes still open I turn away from it, there's a change in consciousness which I did not initiate. I simply turn my head. I didn't say, let there be darkness, and then stay in a dark corner. I turned away my head from the light. The fact that there is a change in the intensity of light as I turn is not my will. I haven't willed the darkening of the light. I simply willed to turn my head away. So I know that I am not responsible as an individual for the light up there, because it doesn't change. When I turn my head away, it goes on shining, but I am looking in another place, which is darker. So because of that, I postulate that it has an objective reality outside this body. And when I open myself to it and allow it to shine into me, I feel certain motions derived from it. If I inhibit all comment on it, then I get its real character. Whereas if I were in the electric bulb business and wondered whether it was Osram or something like that, then my own contribution could obscure it. So if I was selling Osram and that is Mazda or something, I would think it's a bad light or the wrong car. That would be subjective. I would be contributing something to the stimulus. Whereas the ideal is to allow the stimulus to tell you, and not you to tell it. So the whole question of the four is simply this, that a being that might have been aware of itself and its own ripple, we'll draw one, a simple one here, there is a simple state open with no ripple, then there is an initiated ripple from it going out and reflecting back, and that is its self-awareness, but all it knows then is the quality of this circular ripple, or a spherical ripple, if we take a three-dimensional view of it. Where it's contacted another being, and that being is also rippling, there is a ripple coming across. Now that's the first phase when Adam is tempted. Tempted means that he's got a temporal presentation. And time depends on serialization. Simultaneity is not time. So that all these which I've drawn on the paper coexist simultaneously, and that is not a temporal statement. But if I start hopping from one to the other like this, in series, the succession generates the concept of time, although they all coexist on the paper. Their absolute coexistence throughout infinity is what we mean by eternity. Their serial presentation within eternity is the generation of time. So that if this being, instead of comprehending itself in its wholeness and therefore its eternality, becomes aware of another ripple which at one moment starts there and the next moment is there and then there and there and then begins to go back, the time consciousness is generated in it by the successive ripples emanating from outside. So that is called a temptation, namely a temporal presentation of a stimulus. Now, Adam, when presented with, did not have to fall. He could have said, all right, that is a stimulus emanating from outside, but I don't want those from outside. I am commanded to be fruitful, to multiply, to replenish the earth, to dig, etc. And I am going to initiate it. And he could have made very, very strong initiations like this, which would have obscured these ripples. And he could then have got on with his work. Some very strong-minded people have this capacity for overlaying all incoming stimuli with their own thought processes. And when they do that, they are then immune to diversions originating outside. In fact, the story says that Adam failed to initiate from himself, and he responded to the external stimulus. And that response then causes a shift. If you like a thickening, you can see that if we postulate this is energy, the energy, when he responds to the external stimulus, will shift to the perimeter. A very old analysis of it is this. There is matter on the perimeter. And then inside there, there is mind. And inside there, there is spirit. We said before, when we were doing the mechanics of rotation, that the rotation can never go to the dead centre. It goes near it and then comes out again. And we said all this is the action band, and in there is pure spirit. Simply because action cannot get into the centre. So right in the middle of ourselves is spirit, the true self with a capital S. And then round it is a layer of mind, formative principles, and then round that is a layer of matter, which is simply the accretion of motions from outside. Now, inside ourselves we have a tendency to defend ourselves. This, initially, we can't help, because the fact that we exist means that if something from outside sends us a stimulus, we will send back a reaction to it. And if six of these things got together and expanded all at once and forced that one down to ever so tiny, as the philosophers would say, it would still exist. All they would do would make it very hard. Just in the same way, if you get a human being and surround him with environmental stimuli and hammer him very hard, you may make him very small, but you also make him very resentful. You compress his energy into the egoic centre, and then later on, as soon as he can, he will hit back with exactly the amount of force that you pressed him with. This, of course, is very important from the point of view of educational theory. But if you hammer a person down, you haven't caused him not to exist, you merely made him more compact, more hard. So if we remember this division, our gross material body, the subtle body of ideas, here called the mind, and inside the spirit. And we remember that spirit immanent is the same as the one outside, which we call transcendent. And only this action band here determines the obscuration in the mind. Now, there is a gross material body with simply the perimeter of other beings is keeping my gross material body in being by stimulating it. Actually, if we reduce the stimuli on the physical body of a man completely, then that man's mind dominates consciousness and he goes into a state of fantasy. This happens when you're passing from the waking state of body consciousness, which means consciousness of external, into the dream state where you're stimulation. And then if you're lucky, you go right through into the spirit state. So that in a very, very deep sleep, that's S for sleep as well as self and spirit, then the spirit can proceed to send out new initiative powers which repair the mind and the body. And if you don't get into that central state on the inside of the dream, then you don't get the pure efflux of the spirit which moves and organizes the body. So the whole question of the fall is simply the question of externalizing of attention. As this is all energy, if a stimulus comes and causes externalizing, extraversion, then there is a thickening on the outside, just like a crab makes a thick shell. The thick shell of the crab is simply the index of the fear of the crab. It has thrown all it's got onto the outside to protect itself against the external stimulation. So that very, very soft internal being, because of its fear, has thrown all it's got onto the outside. The fact that man's skeleton is on the inside shows that he's got more courage than a crab, because he can afford to soften himself a bit on the outside and enter into experience. Yet on the inside he's made himself hard. All the vertebrates are internally hard, and therefore they have a centre of reference for their being, whereas the crab's reference is on the perimeter. Hence the depositing of the shell on the outside. It's only in the skull that we are crustaceans, which shows that we're a little fearful about the loss of our intelligence. So we've thrown out a protective covering up here to protect the brain. Whenever there's something hard in the body, it is an objectification, a precipitate of fear, protecting. And wherever there's a softness in it, there is some courage exposed. Which is related to this very, very closely. If some ants have a will of their own, there must be some overriding control. And we'll just go through that. If we take any one of these, and remember that if we were to put round it a larger circle, striking the perimeters of the others, we would then have a being of seven parts, six round and one in the middle, and each one would then be called the sub-ent of the whole. Now, one of the concepts in the best oriental philosophy of the whole is this. There is only one supreme whole independent of anything else, and that is the infinite absolute itself. This is the concrete reality. Everything together considered in its totality. And all subsidiary emotions within it are partials. And if you identify with them, then their particular initiation of activity is stepped up. You know that you have three parts. That means a mental center, an affective center, and a volitional center. If you go into a certain kind of environment, it's an intellectual environment, where all the stimuli coming to you hit you in the ear, and all the words related to intellectual problems, they go into intellectual parts of the brain. And the man then may think, I am an intellectual. I am above belly urges and emotional rubbish. And then after that, maybe the circle breaks up, and they go outside, and on the way home, they see some strange shapes. Now, these shapes are not devised for catching the intellect in a mathematical manner. They're devised for another reason. And the result is the consciousness then shifts into another part of the body. It goes into the back of the brain and into the lower part of the body. And then that person thinks that he's no longer an intellectual. He's not quite as narrow as an intellectual. He has other aspects. He's wider, got more understanding. And every time you change the environment, some aspect of your organism is stimulated, and the moment it comes into being, it always comes into being with a little voice justifying itself. Quite correctly, because every single one of these is as valid as any other. So if the belly shouts out, I am very important, it is. And so is the head, and so is the heart. If, when you're in an intellectual circle, you then think that the intellect is the most important, you're simply being deceived by the false stress for the time on one third of your being. And if you were in a pub making merry on a Saturday night and thought that was the most important and said this is the life, etc., then that also would be an error. The fact is that each one of these is exactly as valid as all the others. And none of them can be made absolutely non-existent. If the others start to squeeze it, all they can do is make it harder and more resistant. Like the little hard thing in the centre of a golf ball. So, this question of the sub-ents being raised again. Each one of them, as we've said before, has a little nuclear centre, an intelligence centre, and up to the limit of its own being, the perimeter, in the case of an organ in the body, closing membrane, it is its own king. But over and beyond, it has no authority unless it can step up its initiation to such level that it dominates the ripples in the other beings. And they then become subservient to it. This happens sometimes in the organism when certain organs build up certain chemicals. And when these chemicals have reached a certain level of saturation, they overflow, get into the blood, and they go around and they dictate to the other organs of the body. And during that period, the fellow is slap happy and runs about. like a real genuine goop. And really, it's a particular organ that has released its products into the bloodstream. These have been carried round and then determine the reactions of the others. So there is a real, genuine dictatorship in the body of some organs over some others periodically. And the point is that once saturation point has been reached and these forces are released, then for a period of time it can no longer dominate. It will have to wait. So we can build up those reserves again. We know this in the case of sexual activity, most obviously. But the same thing is true in emotional and intellectual energies. They build up and dominate for a time, and then it appears that the man has compassion or intellectual power, and the mere fact that they are manifesting now means that they will be manifesting later. And to recognize this cyclic nature of all such phenomena is very important. Otherwise you can identify with the activity and think you are improving, and then later when it goes away you think you are deteriorating. If you can accept the cyclic nature of these things, then you are not concerned with improvements and deteriorations as such. You are merely concerned with becoming more and more conscious of all these different activities, knowing that when you become conscious of all of them, control of them becomes spontaneous. So it's again in consciousness that we have to look for the control. It says here, there must be an overriding control to the sub-ends, or we would have no organism. This overriding control is the field. Well, again, electrically, we say that the field is that zone in which the influence of a body can be detected. Now, electrically, the field is really infinite. But in practice, if we take the field of this one up to its perimeter, then this one here, stepping itself up, could obscure any ripple starting from this centre, and therefore the field of this one would be only so far. Whereas if it was so great that it could dominate these six, and by the intensity of its ripplings obscure all theirs, then they would be sub-ends of this one. This is the idea of kingship, really, to make everybody in the country into a sub-ent of the king, and he can manage it. The idea of trade unions is to stop him and set up other centres equally funny. But the important point to realise is that it is entirely a matter of energy, and if we say initially, rub out all the marks and leave only the circles, they are all potentially equal. But if one of them starts rippling and the others start extroverting and attending to his ripples, they are taking orders from him. Whereas if they knew the possibilities, they would resist the first orders and set up their own orders. And that would cause confusion in the other beings. And those other beings then, unless they did the same thing, which would result in a pure democracy, would start trying to evaluate which one of those had the greatest ripple power. Now, we said before, if all six surrounding one decided to expand, they would compress it and make it very, very small. This is the idea of the conservation of force. Let's postulate that each one has a definite amount of force to begin with. But it can extrovert it onto the perimeter and become a materialist. It can introvert it onto the inner centre of the mind and then receive spirit messages, certainly, spiritual significances. It can stay in the middle and ignore the outside and the inside and become an intellectual. And these are its possibilities. So, if one of these beings is aware that if it expands, it can contract these other beings if they're not on guard, and that if he causes them to extrovert, they will start taking orders from him. So obviously, all those beings who have a lust for power over other beings will do their best to extrovert the attention of other beings. This is called bread and circuses. The more external amusements you provide, the more people are easily triggered off into a reaction when necessary. Whereas if you were to train all school children to introvert and become aware of the layers of their own being, if you were an ordinary king, you'd soon be dethroned. Because at a certain point they say, thank you very much, Daddy. We've learned the lesson, we now ignore you. This is the theoretical ideal of all educators, to get the children to the point where they don't need to take any more notice of Daddy. It's an ideal. So, the first part of the statement, servants do have a will of their own, and the overriding control can be considered up to any limit whatever. If we say what is the overriding control for beings on Earth, we could say solar energies. Because if the sun were to go out, they'd go out. Sun worship is one of the earliest religious worships. Simply because people knew that they felt better when the sun was visible than when it was invisible. And that their energies were lower in the middle of the night than they were when the sun had been up in it. So they automatically said that is the cause of our energy. And they worshipped energy as such. They weren't worshipping a stupid ball of light in the sky, simply as a light in the sky. They were worshipping it as a source of energy in them. From the point of view of the solar system, it swims about in another field of the sidereal system. And its motions are determined on lines of least resistance which exist in the sidereal system. And the whole of the system entirely would take us up to the largest circle we can conceive, beyond which we would have to write UN, not ON, and postulate that this big circle has made itself a reflexive, self-feeding system. This is the idea of God. This is why many thinkers say that to postulate an infinite God is to deny God. Because if you talk about the infinite, you're talking about the non-circumscribed. If you want a protective God, you will have to draw a circle and let that represent him. Then you draw a little circle inside it for you. Now you are inside the big circle, and therefore you are safe. Now if you draw a little circle and put it outside the big circle is not taken care of you. So if we take the Advaita view of Shankara in India, which is non-dualist, he does not allow that God, that is this cosmic being, is the highest concept that he's got. He says it's simply the highest protective concept there is, the concept of the totality of being as a personal being. Ramanuja takes this and says, well, that's high enough for me. I'm quite satisfied that there is a cosmic intelligence internal to which I am. The Jewish concept is the same. In him we live, move and have our being. And to say in implies that we have drawn a circle and we put a dot in it. If we draw no circle, then to talk about in is a mistake. So if we feel like being secure, we must first draw a big circle and then deposit ourselves inside it. And if we don't care about security at all, then we could deposit ourselves outside the circle. Absolutely transcendent. And you notice that Christ, when he gives a definition of God, says God is the Spirit. And funnily enough, of course, they say God is a Spirit. The indefinite article is not used. So he's saying God is Spirit. And here he's saying that which is outside the biggest circle of all is what I worship. They're absolutely free. But inside all circles, whatever, he says, then is dominion. Now, the worship of God is said in the Bible to be perfect freedom. His worship is perfect freedom. Free is outside the circle, and dome is inside the circle. And to be able to do both, to make a circle, and say that's security, and dare to go outside it, that's to be free. Free outside, and dome on the inside. And to be able to be free, and yet bound, simultaneously, is the same thing as being absolute and relative. Christ has rendered to Caesar the things that are Caesar's and to God the things that are God's. Now, by God, he there meant, as he defined it, the free, and by Caesar, the dome. We live in society, that's dome. But we don't have to obey all the rules to the letter. We can obey the rules in the spirit of the rules, because we are free. So there are certain things we can interpret, like good lawyers do certain things. There's a very big dome called the law, and it's full of little loopholes, necessarily, because of the tautological nature of the law. Well, the very, very free spirit can penetrate through the loophole and find a way of escaping the dome. And yet, if he's intelligent, he will not try to remove the dome, because that dome is there to keep order. And order is quite valuable for beings in training. So the whole of the gross material world is a training world, whereby consciousnesses, I say plural, because each one is resident in one of these, as a point of initial identification, shall gradually extend the zone of their identity to include other beings, yourself, your family, your nation, the earth, planetary beings generally, solar beings, sidereal beings and so on. You continue to extend your awareness until you include all beings inside your consciousness. And then when you're identified with pure consciousness, which is infinite, then all beings internal to that consciousness with which you are identified are subents of you, if you've done it properly. So, the question of original form here raised, what is the original form? The original form of the field, we said, was simply dynamic impulsations, spherical impulsions, expulsions, going on eternally. Each one is felt simply because the absolute has being, consciousness, mentation, feeling, as its essential qualities. Whenever there's an impulse, it feels itself. An identification occurs at that point, and that is a self, finally. But as each one of those is surrounded by a series of others, when you identify with the larger circle, then you've transcended the smaller one. When you identify with the nation, you transcended your individual family, and so on. Each time you expand, you're actually including within consciousness more energy than you were doing when you thought small. So the men that think universally find they have actually more energy than the fellows who think individually. So if we find somebody, as we would say, petty, egotistic, we find them lacking in energy, lacking in initiative, because they have identified with a very, very small unit. And they're not going to allow their consciousness to spread beyond it. And so the only way they can get energy is by eating very, very rapidly whatever they can grab in the material world. Whereas if you expand and include other beings, that is, beings other than this body, within your consciousness, then the energies of those beings are internal to you as well. This question of energy gaining is entirely a matter of expansion of the sphere of identification. There's a question here about multiple personalities. Well, if we take here, we select three arbitrarily in a row here. Let's pretend those are inside the brain of a human being. And as we said before, let this be the intellectual end, this the affective middle, and that the volitional part of the back, the motor centres. The spinal column will go down here. We cannot act from the intellect immediately onto the muscles or onto the organs of the body. In order to act upon them, we must take the intellection and make it emotive. We must feel like applying it. And so we shift the energy stress along inside the brain. And when it comes to where feeling and volition meet, then it goes down the spine. So in order to activate an idea, we must become emotional about it. We must feel about it. We mustn't flap about it and get out of control. We must deliberately pile up feeling behind it. This can be very, very dangerous if you allow yourself to become romantically, emotionally affected by external stimuli. But if you say, I'm going to deliberately set up a feeling inside myself about an idea that I initiate, I define the idea first, very, very clearly, like a wicked Hitler, and then I deliberately emote about it, then the emotion will transmit, get into the volitional centres, and set up a beat in the volitional centres of other beings, and then they'll rush off and do something silly. First you have to have a clear idea, then you must emote about it and get it thoroughly down in the emotional centres till it contacts the volitional, and then it will cause a reverberation in the volitional centres, like taking something by storm. So multiple personality simply means this: the whole man has these three aspects, and one of his personalities is intellectual, like the one that goes through an intellectual club. Another one is affective; he keeps that for home and custard tarts, and home comforts. And another one here, the volitional one, takes him out rocking and rolling. Each one of these has some divisions. Between the intellectual and the affective, there is a zone where the intellectual activity is concerned with thinking about feeling. So that makes another circle there, a subject, or a personality. And between affection and volition, there is another relating fact. And in each one of these, there is a sub-circle. And if we go on doing this, we will keep adding new circles, getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And the totality of all these constitutes the totality of your personalities, which might express themselves. Now, there's a statement here that the Freudians say that only socially unacceptable concepts are repressed. It isn't true. To say that, it is true that generally those things are repressed, but those very same things can be deliberately expressed in order to annoy somebody. That is repressed, which the being designs is convenient for repression for the time being, even if it's a good thing. You might actually repress the idea that you've just done a good deed, because that deed has been done for a certain purpose and you don't want it to mature yet. And then some other events may come in and crowd upon it, and you may even forget your own good deed. The question of repression of an idea is the question here of your own judgment of the value of stimulation outside in the light of your purpose. You can repress anything, whatever, good or bad. Most people repress those things which would be socially unacceptable. But they suppress also all those things that they want to keep secret, not for social reasons, but because they have another purpose. When Christ says, when you pray, pray in secret, not openly, he's saying, inhibit. Psychologists try to distinguish between conscious inhibition of a thing and unconscious repression. You can suppress, you can repress, you can inhibit all the different levels of consciousness upon it. So, this question of dissociation is now raised. It is a psychological fact that a portion of the total consciousness potential may operate and dominate the whole behavior for a time. The same consciousness is working through you and me, and therefore there's no necessity for this body to do it if that body is doing it adequately.
If I twist that thing down to it,
yeah.
Do you feel it?
Of course I do. Have you never seen a mother feeling her child's bumps? They do it spontaneously, don't they? Child falls to the ground, you hear the skull go like that. You see it, and you feel it. In order not to feel it, you have to shield yourself against it.
Haven't you seen people cringing in other people's sicknesses? Well, egotism is an attempt to shield yourself from that sympathy. Sympathy is the same feeling. Compassion is feeling with someone, suffering with them. And if you're not egotistically guarded with the buffers up, as Goodyear would say, well, then you will have compassion. You will spontaneously suffer with them and joy with them. Their joy is yours, not metaphorically, actually. And their misery is your misery. And it isn't metaphorical. But it strikes at the roots of a materially organized state.
Just true, because you can't be happy if everybody's miserable. Yeah.
Impossible.
Being a good Samaritan, is that not necessarily?
A good Samaritan is doing himself a good turn, isn't he? That's his body down there that got beaten by robbers. And the robbers were bodies of his too. And they're not very well controlled. His first duty is to learn how to control those bodies when he's repaired the body they've knocked about, if he can. Therefore Christ said, I come to bring the sinners, not the righteous, to repentance. The problem for educators is not the clever person. It's the unclever person that's a nuisance.
Very conscious of two opposite feeling states simultaneously, liking and disliking. Is that
If you become sensitive, you'll always find that. In yoga philosophy, every pleasure is rejected as painful, because pleasure causes attachment. Attachment is slavery, and slavery ultimately is painful to that which is essentially free. So we reject pleasure. That doesn't mean we're not enjoying ourselves. One of the first signs of a really religious consciousness is an increase of general happiness. Because you're aware that you're nothing to do with this gross material world at all, because that's only a vibration inside consciousness. And the more you become aware that it is so, the more power over that vibration you have. And therefore, as you become more and more aware of it, you become more and more cheerful about it. In fact, the word cheerful itself means aware of hierarchical powers. Full of power. That's what cheerful means. Should have known we can't hear.
What does Paul mean that in the flesh and spirit? Because I was talking to a man yesterday, and he said, for years I couldn't understand what Paul meant by the flesh. And if I substituted self for the flesh, it became clear to me.
Well, you'd be referring to the egoic self then, wouldn't you? Not the absolute.
Well, that's what you refer to self in another sense altogether.
Well, in the metaphysical sense, we use the word self with a capital S for absolute intelligence.
Yes.
Whereas in the word selfish with a small s, it means egotistic.
Yes.
Identification.
Yes.
You see, this stuff is matter. If I don't identify with that leg, it won't lift. It'll just stay there. And if I withdraw from it completely and don't identify with it, it will just fall off.
Yes.
But if I identify with it, the fact of looking at it as consciousness serving as a catalyst, the blood goes to it, and it's fed. And then when I say rise, it rises. Now, it's entirely in identification of the self with the capital S that the capital S becomes a small s. Remember that S itself is originally a drawing of a serpent. There are two forms of it. That, the open form, that's the terminal form in Greek, and the closed form, the initial and medial. The closed form is the circulating power, and the open one is free. Serpent actually means free hanger, or free thinker. And this capital S refers to the free being, which is the absolute. And the small s is the closed one. So when we talk about the egotistic self, we're talking about the self reduced. And the reduction is caused by identification with the material body.
Well, that would be the flesh.
That would be the flesh. So the self-identification with the material body is what Paul is talking about when he talks about the flesh. and the flesh lusts against the spirit, because actually absolute power either translates, and it's the big S, or it rotates and makes smaller and smaller ones, which become egoic, and finally forget their original free origin, and bound up with their own inertic activities, which were originally free will, but have now become inertic. It forgets its freedom and becomes egotistic and selfish, and that is the flesh lusting against the free. Every free activity is a threat to a bound being. So the slaves do not like to see freedom in other beings, because it appears to them that freedom is the same thing as irresponsibility. I'm bound to my work with a sense of duty. There's a fellow out there in the sunshine doing nothing, shooting. That is the statement of the little circumscribed inertic being against the free one.
That egoic centre you mentioned tonight, is that often confused with the soul?
Oh yes. The fact that the whole of Western culture is based on the idea that the ego is the self. And ego in many cases is Latin, and you know the Latins were interested only in material rulership. Naturally, they centred on the only thing that gave them a reference point, matter. They identified with matter and then tried to rule from it. But it was metaphysically impossible to do so. They learned in a few hundred years' time by losing their power. When they had the power, they said, might is right. When they lost the power, they wondered whether might was right. So they said, only right might is right. The fact is, absolutely, power, when it is ruling, is called right. And when it is not ruling, but it's just rolling along, mowing everything down, is called might. The GH in might and right means effort, power. So Macht, the old pronunciation Macht, the German Macht means power, effort, substantial effort. And Recht, right, means differentiating power. And the man who differentiates accurately in the forms of being can rule it. Whereas a man who rushes at it simply with his substance, being indiscriminate, he will get into trouble and eventually come under the yoke of the right man. The word for king, Rex, means disintegrating or analytical power.
That type of the right.
Oh yes, the right is actually originally a right or power mode deprived of its power. So a religious right is really a behaviour pattern that now no longer has any power in it. If you put R-I-T-E, that is a mode of behaviour no longer powerful. If you empower it, it becomes a rach again. The Hebrew rach, which means ruling power, is the word that they use in the Bible for the Spirit of God moving on the face of the waters. Power rushing along and rippling the surface of universal substance causes all the formal interplay of the universe. That's Rech, the Ruach, the Hebrew. All ruling concepts are based on the meaning of the letter R, which means differentiation, clarity, analytical activities.
And GH is the strength.
GH is the effort. It's the noise you make when you pick up something. You go, ugh. The German, which is a power, conscious nation, and the Scots, where they're still rough, still retain this ugh, this sense of guttural effort.
There is a German word for devil, isn't there, with a similar sound? Rauch. Yeah, the intellect.
Ah, yes.
Isn't
that That's the same concept as the Hebrew idea.
Mm.
Except in the case of the German, it's an obscuration. Because you know that metaphysically the Germans always propound very, very obscure problems.
Mm.
They're famous for inventing questions that nobody can answer. whereas the French are exactly opposite. They only propound questions they can answer.
Is there any point I take up a particular part of what you say, concentrate on it so that I don't actually hear you whilst you continue to talk? Is that what you say, going past the critical faculty because it's busily engaged on this particular part?
No, it is employing the critical faculty on that part. Remember that when you are evaluating a thing, you are criticising it.
It's a particular thing, but meanwhile you're still talking.
Yes.
About something else.
Yes. Well, you see, you're not simply one being, are you? Remember, you have certain cells in your brain that like certain ideas. It's very important to realise that. Just like certain cells in the lower part of the body like sex. There are cells in the brain that like thinking about sex. There are other cells that like thinking about power. There are some that like thinking about eternal truth. And there are some that like to think about what they'll say when they go home, or such and such, in 2 days. Little groups of cells have their own ideas about what to use it for. So that you can have a whole series of processes running in parallel for totally different purposes. And therefore, until you learn to utilise all these and force them to one common aim, you haven't really got a unified governing concept. And the body can never become a battery of energy unless all the molecules in the body are lying down in the same direction. A bar of iron with the molecules lying higgledy-piggledy is not a magnet. A human being with a lot of purposes all over the place does not attract his destiny. And if you line all your impulses towards the same aim, we'll say to the end of personal integration, and you make everything subserve that, gradually the directions of the molecules in the body are changed, and then things become easy that were difficult. And things are attracted from outside your immediate physical sphere. Distance, no object. You could get a special sudden gift from Australia of the very thing you needed without knowing the person who sent it. That kind of thing happens. The moment you get this concept of electrical flow, depending on the polarization and direction of all the parts, all the sub-entities in your being towards the same end, you have then unity of purpose, the ekatitas, one-pointedness that you need. And then, although you're conducting a process in one part of the brain and listening with another part of the brain to what's being said, at the same time there's another part of the brain coordinating the two. One part of the brain can be saturated with an idea to the point of being too tired to attend, and another part can be attending very, very strongly. People can be put to sleep by deliberately selecting a problem that they don't like and then insisting on putting it forward. And then they'll go to sleep on it. And if in the middle you suddenly change the subject to another one, they wake up.
Is it right to say when you get people who do good works like Dr. Bernardo and such people, and also great capitalists like Ford, it's because they have that unifying purpose to achieve those great things?
Well, in an individual case of that order, I should be very, very careful in the analysis. Remember what we said before, that all happiness leads to misery. If you read, say, the biography of Ford, you'll find a real suggestion in his life that he's compensating all the time with his good deeds for the other ones that he feels uncomfortable about. Remember the violence of his use by Ford during certain periods to get work done. You find a man like Nuffield giving millions away. Why does he give millions away? How did he get millions? Does he feel comfortable with all that money when he goes through the world and sees what it's really like? Something in him that collected it must say, get rid of it again. What am I doing with it? There's a time for gathering stones together, it says in the Bible. And there's a time for throwing them away again. And if you die without having thrown them away, you're in a bit of a mess, aren't you? Many of these big benefactors of humanity have been big nuisances first. the first half of the life may be a nuisance and the second half may be a compensation.
What about the optimist then?
Well, we've already dealt with them. They're either labouring under a false concept that they should benefit other beings, and they're only egotistical to postulate other beings. You can't say there are other beings unless you're an egotist, can you? So the declared altruist is declaring himself an egotist. And he's saying, I'm killing my egotism. Look at me. Aren't I a wonderful altruist? Myself? You see, you can't use the term altruism without being an egotist. This is always so, you get in the Tao Te Ching, to define beauty is to define ugliness. So if you take any great man that's left, say, the Rockefeller Foundation, how did he get so much money? On one occasion, some farmers came to Rockefeller and paid back £1 million they'd borrowed off him. And he burst into tears and turned to his manager and said, find me another borrower quickly. This is a fact in his life. To him, you have to do something with it. And you can't find people to borrow £1 million every day. Half a crown, yes, but they're no good to you. So you've got to penetrate behind this. Where you get this terrific drive to accumulate matter, simultaneously with it, they're sowing the seeds of trying to get rid of it. And as the deeds that they did, usually, to get it, are rather dark, the deeds that they'll do to get rid of it are very light. So the newspapers will say, another £1.5 million from Mr. Silver for such and such.
This also applies to knowledge, does it not? Just taking in and giving back?
Oh, yes. Good night. If we remember that everything except the self is material, knowledge itself is material.
Yes.
It is a vibration of prime matter. And therefore, it's like any other matter, it can be distributed. You may notice sometimes in children in the same family, one of them is showing a certain talent, and another one comes along and joins in, and the first one drops it. It very often happens. Just as if there was so much of that talent, and if he's using it, the other one isn't. And if the other one joins in, it becomes less valuable, so he lets go of it. This is the meaning of the idea of to him that hath, and to him should be given. If you've got a little bit of that frequency, it'll attract and get a bit bigger if you let it. But if you won't let it accumulate, it'll start going away again to somebody who will. It's a definite amount of a peculiar character of vibration or motion. And that motion is, like everything else in the universe, absolutely conserved. So there's a certain amount of the vibration called intellect in the world. There's a certain amount of emotional response. If you've got it, somebody else is losing it. That's why the sage, the moment he discovers he's sage, prefers simplicity because he discovers he's robbed everybody. In order to become wise. So he spends the rest of his time trying to regain simplicity. And say, now you be wise, please. It's very uncomfortable. You be. Then once you shift the stress accent behind the material world, identify always with the intelligence to consciousness. Use the rule that the observer is not the observed. The word ob, without the R in it, means an orb, but when you put the R in it, it means a rotating orb. So the object is really a sphere thrown into consciousness. So that the objective consciousness itself is a consciousness with an object in it. Now the observer is the consciousness, the true self. And it cannot be the observed. The material world is the observed, when people identify with it. But the observer is not. So behind the observer and the observed, those of which obs are under the observer, the self identified with the is the observer, and the in the self is the object, the observed. Behind both of those is the absolute intelligence. If you identify with that, you don't see observer and observed. But you've taken the observer out of it completely and put him back into the absolute where he belongs. And you then see everything else as internal to this consciousness. A vibration complex there, another one here, and so on. And you're not a bit surprised when people react in one way rather than another, because there's a great law that's called the inequality of finites that says that no two spheres, no two objects, can be identical in their motion content. Therefore, they must respond differently to identical stimuli. So it doesn't surprise you at all if people are unequal, or if one is a genius and the other a halfwit. You just see it and accept it as such. And when consciousness sees a thing, if it comments upon it, it has the power to say, stay that way or change. This is called the keys of loosing and binding. If a person of full consciousness says to somebody, you are the kind of being that does that, it will stick. And if he says, you are the kind of being who used to do that but isn't going to do that anymore, then it will change. That's part of the meaning of the statement, that when you can see the objective truth and state it, then without you having to work, certain things happen. Everything depends on severing the observed from the observer and taking the observer out so he no longer serves the ob.
When you speak of absolute intelligence, is it possible for me to understand within the Gurdjieff terminology what you are indicating here?
Well, you know Gurdjieff's cosmological divisions, and he has a most holy son absolute.
Yes.
Well, he's thinking, this is a question of stress on him, you know. He's an empiricist himself, a man working through the material world in order to develop certain things the empirical way. This is the way of the man in the world that he always talks about. What is called in the song the low road. You know, there's the high road, the a priori road, and the low road. And for most people, the low road is the shortest way to Scotland. I'll be in Scotland before you, if I take the low road, the empirical road. Now, at the other end, there is an absolute source of illumination, the most holy and absolute. This is continuously radiating out substantial light. You know, light has two aspects, the electromagnetic wave and the photon, the unit. There's a definite amount of light being radiated by the sun, daily, and by all the stars, and by the absolute sun, central. This light is intelligent light, it's not rubbish. This light actually organizes matter. It's that light that makes things appear on the earth, that grows plants and then evolves and so on. Light is intelligence. If the light of the eye be dark, how great is that darkness, says Christ. And if the light of the eye be single, notice he doesn't say the light of the eye be light, he says be single. If the light be dark, how great is the darkness? If the light be single, the whole body is full of light. It's this orientation towards one idea that causes the polarizing of the body, and then the absolute sun, which really is not far away at all, it is everywhere, and all other suns are internal to it, only its frequency is so high that it actually appears darkness to low-level organisms. That sun is the light that lights every man that comes into the world, and it appears in intellectual men as intellect, and in other men it appears as common sense when they have it, and in some it's so obscured you can hardly believe there is a light. Nevertheless, the fact that there's an organic process going on in the body is a proof of that light, because that light is the only intelligence. But that light is not matter. Because we do not use the term matter unless we're talking about the rotations of power. The matura. You see, we have matura, natura, and hatura. Hatura is spiritual law. Natura, nature, is growing law. And matura is inertia law. So we only say matter when we refer to rotation. If the same force is translating, we don't call it matter at all. If it's growing through a body, we call it natura, nature. If it's appearing as initiative and will, it is Hatora, the name of the first five books in the Old Testament, you see. Hatora means the spirit law. So really the whole process, and the shortest way to it, is simply persistently to look at whatever there is, and if it is formed, that is if it is finite, deny that it belongs to the observer. The server of the ob is not formed. So you deny, when you see anything finite, whatever, that it is the observer, and you immediately refer to consciousness. This is good, yes, self-remembering, you see. You turn yourself back and say, the observer is not the observer, so whatever I can see is not the I.
That's that I shaped like that.
You see? That is the I, which is a catalyst. Because when you remember it, you change the world. You actually change the configuration of impulses in your own brain. When you look at them, simply to look at them changes the configuration. They don't change for a man that is not self-conscious, in this high sense, not the low sense of self-conscious, bashful and blushful. The inertic man, when he looks at things, doesn't look self-conscious with a capital S. He simply looks at the object, and it acts upon him, and he is passive to the stimulus. Yet when you turn it back on yourself and say, the observer is not the observed, the observer, the server of the ob, is infinite, pure intelligence, without limit. So you scrub out all the limits and retain that. Say, I in that. But not the I of the ego, not identified with the body. The I that's called pure witness, the sakshin of the yogis. It's just a looking, an awareness of looking, nothing else. There's no comment, just looking. When Christ says, what I see the Father do in secret, that I do openly, he's referring to the intersection point of the absolute in his divinity with his humanity. He looks backwards into the abyssal centre of the absolute, and it is always doing something, because the word static cannot be applied to it. Static only applies to material objects opposed to each other. So it's always doing something. He sees what it is doing, and then he deliberately copies it in the material world, knowing that whatever it is doing is absolutely right. One of our modern philosophers, Diaspis, has pointed out that the categorical imperative of Kant, which says that we should act as all rational men would act in that situation, is a bit long-winded and requires an awful lot of thinking. So he puts in its place the non-categorical imperative, the absolute imperative. That is to say, it is imperative without formally stating what. And then when you're conscious, the absolute imperative works through you. But something can be done at any given moment. You can't see what empirically, because your empirical reason works on the past, and the past, if it's allowed to work, simply establishes inertia. So you climb out of the inertic memory traces by the absolute imperative, the unconditional imperative. It doesn't look to see what's got to be done in the empirical world. It looks backwards. And there it says, disanta. And what it says is new. Behold, I make all things new, says the Lord. Because there is something that can be done that's never been done before. If you refer to the empirical reason, you'll do something done before. If you refer to the unconditional imperative, what you will do has never been done before. And nothing can be said about it. It's a straight push through from the action. It's a new finger from the absolute into the time process. And that's really the thing to aim at. When it is said that the yogi aims to go beyond intellect, to transcend absolutely all determinations whatever, it's just another way of saying, let's get to the unconditional imperative. Or rather, the unconditional imperative has been borrowed by people to study the same source concepts. And there is a point where you reach in consciousness, you can say, well, I look backwards and I do so and so. And it's absolutely right. It can't be wrong. It doesn't really matter whether anybody empirically doesn't like it. It was the needed thing at that moment. And later on they will know it was a needed thing at that moment and be glad of it. Although there may be some individual reactions at the moment. Gurdjieff was deliberately, frequently, bringing in these things and throwing them at some of his pupils and upsetting them. Because they couldn't understand why he said such awful things sometimes. But that he brought them out of this consciousness that's beyond the empirical. And then they shocked the empirical level. And in that shocking, they were made loose. And in the fear, the trembling, an idea could be inserted. And because they were afraid, they grabbed at the idea. You remember, Uspensky built a system. Yeah, good, he said, there is no system. And when Uspensky went to America and came back, he said to his pupils, there is no system. He was a system maker. That's the spin in him, the thinker. When he'd made it, he found he'd made a form which bound him. Which wasn't what he wanted to do. You can't have a form, you can't have a system. System means sus tem, saviour for a time. That's all it means. So, you can't have a system that frees you and lets you into the absolute. Systems belong to time. They're very nice. Systems of philosophy are very nice. In time, but they're no good for a man that wants to transcend all limitations whatever and to spring into absolute free without the dome. The most powerful exercise anybody can do is simply to put the consciousness between the eyebrows there. And when anything happens, whatever it is, whether it's likable or not likable, say, this is an object of consciousness. It is not the self. And scrum it out. And immediately turn the consciousness back and sit there. If you do nothing else other than that, the whole body begins to focus on that point. That's the one pointedness of mind. When you get it, you can shift it about. But until you get it there, you can't shift it about. It floats about. And it depends on the one rule, the observer is not the observed.
Yes, isn't it Rolf who has some theory? He had an idea, most of his theory, I remember reading something. I often puzzled how it was to be done. He all the way through the book about this exercise of maintaining the consciousness here between the eyebrows. I was interested in this. I seem to remember his name was Alexander Rolf, or Rolf Alexander.
Yeah. Yes. Of course, Descartes placed the seat of the soul back in your gland.
Sorry, again?
Descartes placed the seat of the soul in the pineal gland, you know. It's related to this unpaired eye bearing here. The funny one of that pseudo Tibetan pretended he had bored, you know. In fact, if you want to develop it, you must make a mark mentally. When you're shaving, look at that point and say, I should be there. Am I there? And when there's no mirror there, go like that and say, I should be there. Am I there? And postulate that third eye. A centre of awareness there. You become aware of a field circulation there. You feel uncomfortable that there's something there. There is. Keep it there. And don't try to formulate what it should do, because that's an imposition from the empirical side of the mind. You can't possibly know. Just postulate it, and then the energy begins to roll round in there. And once it has set itself up, the rest of the body drifts towards it because it is the natural law of the body. The fall is simply a fall from there, down, from there, the midbrain, the emotional part, then to the hindbrain, the motor, down the spine into the forward parts of the fleshly body. That is the fall, physiologically. If you climb up there, you've reversed the fall process. There's another place I'm here to concentrate on. On the top. But you shouldn't do that until you've got this completely established, because this one is non-personal. and this one is personal. You become more I there, you become less I there.